Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And along with our call, Zorba, some topics to talk about.
Yes, teen birth rates, they have dropped, but so has teen promiscuous sex. And we're going to talk about changes that are occurring in our society right now and actually have been occurring over the last 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to talk about feeling anxious when you get a vaccine. You know, you're sitting in the doctor's office, my office, and you're getting ready to get a shot and get a vaccine. How does that actually affect you? And it actually may make your vaccine more effective. Mm-hmm.
And a recipe?
Skyla's Savory Veggie Pizza. It is delicious. I promise you'll love it.
1-800-462-7413. And a listener now, Zorba in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Zorba. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, here's my thing. Every year when we transition into winter and out of winter, I go through a period of about a week and a half where I have really dry scalp. And there's some dandruff and stuff, and usually that's easily taken care of with typical head and shoulders. This year, however, it's just hung on for like 3 weeks and more, and I've tried various kinds of dandruff shampoos. It's not really too visible. I mean, I can get most of it out of my hair and brush my hair, and it's okay, but if I run my fingers through my hair or whatever, it's like I'm living in a snow globe. I just see all this dandruff and dry scalp falling down in front of me. It's not itchy. It's just annoying. What can I do?
Yeah, it sounds annoying. Can you trigger this to anything? Did you do anything or anything happen that started this?
No, there's been no change in my diet. There's been no change in any product that I would be using on my hair. It's really kind of puzzling me this year because I'm used to it. You know, like I said, it's only a period usually about a week, week and a half, and it's very easily controlled with typical head and shoulders type stuff.
Yeah, a snow forest of dandruff. It's not exactly what you're looking for, especially if you're wearing any kind of dark clothing. So over-the-counter shampoos, Selsun Blue, is that one of the ones you tried?
Exactly, yep.
Uh-huh. Well, a couple of ideas. First of all, your dandruff, sometimes your dandruff will go through a period of time where it's actually getting worse. And now, it may be getting worse because of the way it is the season or, you know, just like all other skin problems we have, sometimes they just get a little bit more aggravated than others. What you need probably, most likely, there are a couple of things. First of all, I would initially try, before you see your doc, an over-the-counter tar shampoo. Now, Have you tried a tar shampoo at all?
A tar,
right. Well, it's actually made out of tar, and it's an old-fashioned remedy. A T-gel is one of them. It's an old-fashioned remedy. Put that on your scalp. You let it sit there for about 5 or 10 minutes, then you wash it off, and then you can use regular shampoo on top of that. And I would probably use Selsun Blue on top of that afterwards. And the tar has a little bit of a smell to it. It sort of almost smells like tar. Shock of shocks. And that old-fashioned remedy works really, really well for lots and lots of people. And it's not used by lots of people because it's tar. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons. It's not sticky like tar. I would try that first. Go to the pharmacy. Say you want the best tar shampoo that there is. Try that out. It is stronger than the over-the-counter shampoos that you can get and see if that works. Now, if that fails, what you're going to have to do is call your doc about getting one of the prescription shampoos. Selsun comes in a prescription strength that's stronger. Sebulex is another one. Nizoral, N-I-Z-O-R-A-L, is another one. There are a whole bunch of them. And they're basically stronger, and they'll do the job. They'll do the job. And once again, it's probably going to be just like you have before. Once you get it under control, it's fine. You just need something stronger.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Yeah, no fun having a snowstorm on your black suit.
Thanks a lot for the call.
You know, I'm sitting here, Zorba. I do every now and then when the question comes
you
in.
You sit there?
Is this something I have? Is something I have to be worried about? I'm thinking, gee, I don't have to be worried about dandruff. And then I think, oh, wait a minute, there's a good reason for that.
That's right. That's right. It's the hair challenge problem. The hair challenge problem.
800.
Me too. Me too, obviously.
1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. To Cincinnati, Ohio, we go now. Hello.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I started suffering from what I thought were migraines. I went to see a doctor, was treated for migraines, had a couple of root canals done, was treated for sinus infections. I even had one physician in an emergency room tell me that I needed to see a psychotherapist for depression. Mm. After a few years of suffering with this tremendous pain in my face and in my head, I was finally diagnosed by a neurologist with trigeminal neuralgia. Mm-hmm.
By the way, not an unusual way, not an unusual history for being documented and finally coming up with the diagnosis of trigeminal
Can you neuralgia. Spend a moment talking about that, Zorba, before we...
Well, it's the trigeminal nerve is the nerve that feeds our head, basically. It's the nerve that gets stimulated when we have a toothache. Does anyone want a toothache? No. When we have an eye problem, when we get hit in the nose, anything sensory, basically within the head, practically anything sensory, most things sensory, are from the trigeminal nerve. And when that nerve decides to become irritated for some reason that we don't understand, it's awful pain. And there's no way of treating it, diagnosing it, mm-hmm. other than clinically imagining it and then diagnosing it. So you went to a neurologist and they made the diagnosis of trigeminal neuralgia, this kind of funky nerve, if you will, that's just flashing this terrible, terrible pain. And so go on.
They've had me on medication, 500 milligram Depakote, which they have increased over the past year. I started at 500 milligrams. I'm now up to 2,000 milligrams of Depakote a day. And apparently that's to control that specific nerve ending and kind of deaden it. But I would say over the past 2 months, I've been having episodes where the pain is tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of looked on the internet, which my neurologist warns me against, but I've gone to the low-fat diets, the low-salt diets, mm-hmm. minor exercise, soft music, loud music, and it's not making any difference anymore. The Depakote level at 2,000 milligrams is a lot of Depakote to be taking. Mm-hmm. I also, for the pain, take hydrocortisone, mm-hmm. 500 milligrams of hydrocortisone 6 or 7 times a day.
Uh-huh.
If the pain gets too immense, I'm on oxycodone.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, it can be just terrible. I like the fact that your neurologist warned you against going to the internet.
Yeah.
It's like, be careful. Information is bad. Don't even bother. But your neurologist is right in one way. There's a lot of junk, garbage in, garbage out of the internet. But there's also some good information. But it was very interesting, and that's not an uncommon approach. First of all, you're on an anti-seizure medication. Depakote is one of the medications that's used for seizures. Tegretol, T-E-G-R-E-T-O-L, is another one, and in fact was pretty much the first medication that was used for trigeminal neuralgia. So if you're getting breakthrough on this particular anti-seizure medication, what you really do need is to talk to your neurologist about switching to another one. And sometimes that'll do the trick, just switching. There are a number of anti-seizure medicines, and if one doesn't work, you try another one. If that doesn't work, you try another one after that, especially since you're having some breakthrough pain. That's what I would recommend. The goal is to reduce the amount of hydrocodone and oxycodone, which are opioids for this, not only because they're opioids and they have side effects, constipation, dizziness, inebriation from them, but also because they really don't work as well as the anti-seizure medicines. So I would think that switching from Depakote to Tegretol or one of the other drugs in that class is really what I would do.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Bye-bye. 1-800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. So, Zorba, not only are teen pregnancies down, but fewer teens are having sex than
teen pregnancies are down quite a bit. It's amazing. And the teen pregnancies for teens from the ages of 15 to 19 fell in nearly all states in the country. Very few states did they go up. They really fell. The rate of teen births fell by 9%. Which is a huge drop because teen pregnancy was going up, the lowest reported in the last 65 years. There's a huge difference.
Right.
Huge difference. Undoubtedly, I would immediately say, well, that's probably because teens are learning more about birth control. Mm-hmm. They're still having sex, but that turns out not to be the case. It turns that teens are also having less sex now than they did 10 years ago. That's made a big difference. So the baby rate has been dropping, the teen sex rate has been dropping too. The number of teens who have had sex who are actually using condoms has increased by 32%. So education is actually working.
This is surprising, especially in the light of our media now. So much young person sex going on, sex talk going on.
Well, you would think so. You know, with Snooki and, you know, and everyone on TV, you would think
case. The new sitcoms are young people, maybe not teens, but you're having sex all the time with everybody.
Right. No. That's exactly it. But it turns out that these rates of depth, and if you look at promiscuous sex, and that's teens who have sex with four or more partners, that's dropped by 26%. These are major drops in society. So I think what we're doing is we're seeing a change. We're seeing that teenagers, number one, are paying attention to who they're having sex with, and they're not having sex at the same early age that they were before. Yeah. They're not having promiscuous sex, and if they are having sex, they're actually using condoms or birth control and preventing, you know, and preventing pregnancy. I look at this as a very positive thing in our society. Having a baby at a young age, between 15 and 19, I have a very busy practice in my small town, and I had a perfect example. I had a mom in there, a mom with me the other day with her daughter, and we were talking about things. The mom was 32. She had her child. She had her child in there. She had the child when she was 16. And I was talking with her and her daughter, and I said, and her daughter was, maybe she was 34, so the daughter was like 17. I can't remember, but right around there. And I said, what advice do you give to your daughter? And she said, the advice is that I have is, I love you, darling. You shouldn't have a kid this young, as young as I did, because I didn't have a chance to enjoy myself as a teenager. I had to grow up right away and take care of you. And she's a really good mom, and she has a really good child. But it's so difficult being a teen, having a child, because for a lot of them, it's the grandparents that then raise that child.
Yeah.
So this is good news.
It is. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener now in St. Augustine, Florida.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, what's up?
Well, it's interesting that you're talking about statistics, because that's what my question has to do with. I read different articles about how to stay healthy, and when I look at the percentages for my chance of getting diabetes, it's really low because I'm not overweight. And lung and breast cancer, I don't smoke and I don't have the breast cancer gene. And then with heart attack, I have very low chance, without going into all the details. And for Alzheimer's, I exercise and I get the pneumonia and flu shot. So if I add up all the percentages, it looks like I can't die because I have such a low percent. And I was wondering what you do when you add all those percents together. I mean,
well, you
understand them separately.
You answered it. You live forever. I mean, that's the answer. You can't die. As long as you stay away from the percentages, you'll be just fine.
Or maybe, as she kind of suggested, if you have a 9% of this and a 12% of that and a 4%, by pretty soon you end up with 100%. And then you're dead.
And then you're dead the other side.
Well, I was thinking of it the other way around. I was adding up the percents that you won't get it.
You know, there's a Greek paradox. I can't remember the name of it now for the life of me. Where you get halfway. It's a paradox. And how do you arrive at something? Because you get 50% there. And then when you have 50% left, you get 50% there.
You never get there.
You never get there. And I don't remember what it's called, but it's called something. It's paradox. Yeah. And that's exactly what applies here. I bet our listeners know the name of whose paradox that is.
I'm sure one of our listeners will never hear
in our inbox. I've got to figure out whose paradox it is.
Yeah.
But But these are relative percentages. And the important thing about this, like you said, you're at low risk for getting diabetes, okay? And getting all these things. But you're not at a low risk for getting older. What happens is when you get to be a certain age, your risk for getting the disease pops up tremendously, even though your relative risk is less. So let's say heart disease, perfect example. Mm-hmm. Your risk might be low at 50 because you're doing everything right. At 60, it's still low. At 70, it's still low. You're a woman. At 80, it's still low. But when you get to 85, the age risk comes in and pops it way over. Because you're 50%, if you're 85, the chances that you'll live to 90 is 50%. And the chances are you're going to die of a heart attack at that point. So what happens is, at a certain point, you really cross a threshold and the risk zooms because of age. You haven't considered age in the calculations. And age is your increased risk. So I've got an answer for this. If you can stop aging, you can live forever.
Right. I think what you were thinking of is, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but Zeno's paradox.
Oh, Zeno's paradox.
But I have to admit, I'm sitting in front of a computer, so I have to.
Multitasking,
that, so, yeah.
Zeno's paradox.
Right.
There we go.
So as long as I can figure out how to stop the clock running, I'll be okay.
Absolutely. And you know what? When you figure that out, would you please give me a call?
Okay. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You. We appreciate the call. Really good news for our 85 and 86-year-old listeners.
That's right. You're going to be dead in the next 5 years. 50% of you aren't going to be here, which is why you should consider contributing to public radio in your will. If you're 85, put it in there.
Not today. Not only do
support
we give you terrible
news, radio.
But we try to bleed you before you go. Go away. Well, before the break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take a quick question from Carrie, who loves our show and needs your help to try and kick a bad habit. Carrie asks, anything new out there to help with nail biting? I'm over 50 and I've done it all my life. I've tried quitting numerous times, polish mostly, but I've been unsuccessful. I also have a habit of picking at my nails and cuticles. Any suggestions?
Oh, that's a tough one. That is really, really tough. You know, as you said, there's certain things that you put on your nails to make them taste bad.
Yeah.
But people who have been nail biting for years, they just bite them around. And besides, when parents paste it on your fingers, it's one thing in your child. But when you put those things on your fingers, you can scrunch a little bit so you're not actually doing it over the entire nail. The only recommendation is this is an obsession.
Mm-hmm.
So there is cognitive behavioral therapy that works for some to help with obsessions. Sometimes there are medications that help with obsession, antidepressants and antipsychotics that also work along with cognitive behavioral therapy because you're not going to stay on that drug forever. At the age of 50, my thought is you may not get rid of the nail biting completely, mm-hmm. but maybe you could cut it down by 50 to 75%. And that might be the best that you're going to be able to get because that's a habit that is so highly ingrained. But find yourself a good psychotherapist in your town who specializes in obsessions, and that's the one to go to.
Did you bite nails as a kid?
No, I bit #2 lead pencils. And in fact, when I think about it even now, I would just love to chew a #2 lead pencil right now. I wish I had one. You know, I could afford to buy a whole package now and just chew away, but I don't do it. But the thought of it makes me feel really good.
Cheaper than cigarettes, which you also crave.
That's right. That's right. Cheaper than cigarettes. And you know what? Better for you.
Yeah.
Maybe that should be my cure. Stop smoking cigarettes and chew #2s. I like the sound of it.
You can always pick Zorba's brain, just not his nails. So if you have a lifestyle question for the show, just send them along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our recipe is coming up next. More of your calls, too. Some more interesting research to talk over. Our recipe is coming up next. Lots more of your calls, of course, too. Some interesting research to talk over. And we have our medical myth buster for you later on in the hour. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up at 1-800-462-7413. But first, recipe time. And for this recipe, we are happy to welcome from Nibley, Utah, listener Skyla Christensen. Skyla, hi.
Hi.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us about Skyla's savory veggie pizza.
Well, our family's aspiring to vegetarianism, but none of it seems really satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
So this was kind of our best attempt at finding something hearty and meat-free.
So it's you're aspiring to be vegetarian. In other words, partially successful or partially failed vegetarianism.
Mostly failed.
Mostly failed.
Our values don't trump our taste buds yet.
I love it. Taste buds trump values when it comes to food.
Now, how did you put this one together? How'd you come up with the idea and the ingredients?
You know, I was hungry, and I didn't want to go to the store, and mm-hmm. a lot of this was what we had on hand from our produce co-op food basket. So I had pizza crust and these particular vegetables on hand, and
It's a great idea. You know, the idea of taking pizza and making it into a healthier dish, I think, also really makes a difference. Pizza... You know, gosh, if you look at how much pizza is consumed in America, you know, it's kind of like burgers, pizza, hot dogs in that realm. And you can certainly, pizza is a good example of something that you can make healthier.
Right.
You know, and do in a different way. You know, when I was a kid, I mean, it was basically sausage, green pepper. There were like five things that were on pizza. Then there was anchovies. We always said yuck to anchovies. And that was it. Now you go into many pizza places, there's a variety, but why not make it at home? And it's so much cheaper at home to make it. It is so much cheaper. Okay, so we're going to go through part of the recipe. First of all, so when you make your own pizza crust, because we'll start out with the crust, do you make it from scratch?
I don't. Mm-hmm. I used the Pillsbury rollout from the, refrigerated section
okay.
crust.
And there are a variety of ways. I just want to spend a bit of time on the crust mm-hmm. because I've used the Jiffy for the crust. I've used the Pillsbury crust. Then I've made the crust myself from a couple of different recipes. And we're going to put the crust recipe that I like on our website. It's very, very simple to make your own crust. We have a bread machine at home that I got as a gift. And all I had to do is pop the ingredients in the bread machine, and the bread machine makes the crust, and I put it in the refrigerator. Something interesting, if you really like thin crust, which I happen to like, mm-hmm. if you make this recipe that I'm going to put on the, as I said, website, which is really a simple recipe, very similar, and you refrigerate it for 2 to 3 days before you make the pizza, the crust becomes crispy. And I have no idea why, but if you like a crispy crust, you can do that. And then, of course, there are box crusts that people can mm-hmm. use. So.
Well, let me ask you, when you make your own and you roll it out, does it stay rolled out? That's my problem. It shrinks back down, the stuff in the tube.
You know what you do? It tends to shrink down, and what you've got to do is use oomph. You got to push down, but that's exactly does. It does shrink down, but that's my exercise for the day, is getting it rolled out.
All right.
It's my upper body exercise for the day, is getting it, but it does tend to shrink back. Okay, so one pizza crust, 2 carrots finely chopped.
Right.
1/3 cup of walnuts finely chopped. Ooh, I love walnuts. I'm sure you could use another type of a nut, but walnuts are really good. I'd probably use pecans, maybe would work. Kale. So do you use much kale? At all?
I'm trying to use more. We make kale chips is the only thing Ooh. That we ever do with kale, but it was good on this.
You know, kale is becoming a green that was being used more and more and more. For years, I mean, my mother never heard of kale because she never heard of squash. But, I mean, kale... Kale is becoming used more and more. Tom, have you ever used kale?
Well, I'm just
kale?
Trying. I always turn my nose up when I hear the word kale.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I've ever even tasted kale.
Yeah. Well, you've got to go out and try to taste it. It's got,
I should. You're
it's
right.
a you know, it's not bland like lettuce. It has a definite taste to it, and I don't know how I would describe it, but it's kale.
When you get the lettuce mixes. Uh-huh. Is kale ever in those?
I don't think so. I don't know if kale's in the lettuce. Some of them, probably some.
Anyway. Kale is the garnish on the side of your hamburger when you go to a sports bar.
That's it, though.
Oh, that's what it is.
It's the garnish.
Instead of sending it back the plate with the garnish on, I'll actually eat the kale.
That's right. Get rid of this garnish. Yeah. Okay, a half broccoli crown separated into small bits, of course. Half a teaspoon of minced garlic. I like this. So 2 tablespoonfuls of Worcestershire sauce, which my English aunt used to pronounce Worcestershire sauce.
Yeah, right.
No, she was. Right. No, my aunt was English. My grandparents were English. You can't tell from the way I talk, but 1/4 cup of water. They put in, and then pizza sauce. You use a pre-made pizza sauce, 2 tablespoonfuls.
I use our home canned stuff, but I think from the store it's just the same.
Ooh, so you can your own pizza sauce during the tomato season? Is that what you do, or you just?
We do, and we leave the seeds in for a little bit of a crunch and flavor. So.
I think it's great. I love it. And then for your topping, you're going to use nutritional yeast, a tablespoonful. When I was looking at this recipe before I talked to Tom, I said, "Do you know what nutritional yeast?" But you're even laughing before I finished with it. It's got a distinct smell to it that I kind of like, but some people like and some people don't. Do you like nutritional yeast?
I do. I read that it was a great replacement for cheese. I disagree with that now that I've used it. I enjoy it for its own
thing.
So you could also use Parmesan cheese if you don't dig the nutritional yeast.
No, you could definitely use Parmesan. The concept that nutritional yeast could possibly replace cheese in Wisconsin is an anathema. No one would ever believe you. I could just see people eating nutritional yeast sandwiches, toasted. Never, not in a million years.
No, thanks.
So let's make it. So preheat the oven to 400 degrees, then preheat the crust in a skillet or a pan or on a stone for half the recommended cooking time. Chop the carrots, walnuts, and kale in a food processor, or if you want to, with a chef's knife. Add the chopped veggies to a microsafe bowl with the broccoli that's already torn apart. Garlic, Worcestershire sauce, and water. Put the lid, microwave for 5 to 6 minutes until the veggies are tenderly steamed. You could also put it in a bamboo steamer and just steam them on the stove if you want to. Then remove the crust from the oven, put the sauce over it, add the Worcestershire softened veggies on the top, sprinkle the yeast, or if you prefer, as I would, Parmesan cheese, return to the oven until the crust is lightly browned. Serve and enjoy. Dynamite recipe. I think this has the fullness. There's this concept called umami, which is that some things produce a fullness, and that really has it. The walnuts, the carrots, the kale, the Worcestershire sauce, they all had different parts of the taste. They really do. So it's great. So was this a hit in your home?
This was a hit, yeah. I always try these kind of, I don't tell anyone it's vegetarian, so they've eaten it and they've liked it. And my husband always catches me and hates it. He's tricking me again. And on this one, he said, yay, it's a winner.
That's great.
It's a winner. That's good. And you know something? I think you hit the ball right out of the park with this. What you want to do is you want to find, even if you're not going to be a vegetarian or a vegan, we want to eat more vegetables and less animal products. So we have to find the food that we like, and then we don't have to eat all vegetarian recipes. We have to find things that really hit our taste buds that we find tasty and then reproduce those. Just like in a restaurant, there's certain foods you like. This is a great recipe. We are going to have lots of people who want to have this.
Skylar, it sounds yummy, and we thank you very much for it.
Thank you so much.
And for sending us this winning recipe, Skyla gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on your health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba. A listener with us in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
going today?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I just had a quick question about the use of Tramadol for long-term chronic pain. I've been on it for about 3 years and tried to go off it a couple times and just pretty much to no avail. They've tried using gabapentin a couple times, but didn't have the desired effect, and there's some wicked withdrawal issues. I'm just seeing what kind of ideas you might have.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, Tramadol, which is an excellent drug for pain, it's a unique medication in that it is a weak opioid. So in other words, it fits into the narcotic class. Mm-hmm. It's not scheduled. Well, because scheduled, so it's not generally viewed as a drug of addiction, although getting off of any opioid can be problematic. And it works a little bit like what's called an SNRI. It works a little bit like an antidepressant in terms of a reduction of pain. So it's a combination of two things together. It's not a combination pill, but the drug itself, the medicine itself, is unique. It's one of the most widely used painkillers in Europe. It's got some play in America, not nearly as high. And I've done some research on it, and I've spoken about it in the past. So when you try to get off of this, like I said, it is a weak narcotic. What sort of problems do you have?
Probably a few hours if I miss a dose, mm-hmm. or if I run out due to, prescription refill errors or something. Body aches. Joint pain.
Sure. How much are you taking?
50 milligrams four times a day.
Okay, so you're on 200 milligrams a day,
yep.
which is generally the top dose that most people will take for that. Well, if you miss a dose, as you say, what you're doing is you're going through withdrawal. That's what
yep.
you are. Now, before you took Tramadol, did you continue to have the pain? Is this the most effective drug for you?
Yeah, it's been the most effective. They've tried hydromorphone,
uh-huh.
Oxycontin.
Right, right. Much stronger drugs, not nearly as good. They have more side effects and more inebriation than that. Are you on an anti-inflammatory, naproxen, ibuprofen, any of those?
For a long time, for about a three-year duration, I was on 3,200 milligrams of ibuprofen a day.
Okay, that's quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Quite a bit. And then the doc was like, you know what, if you can taper off of that, we'll see if you can taper off the ibuprofen, and then eventually the Tramadol. They just wanted to see where it's at because the diagnosis or the prognosis for recovery was about 4 to 5 years.
Uh-huh.
They were hoping some of the pain would subside.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, I think it has, but like I said, when I try to go off of it.
Okay. I've got a couple of suggestions. Number one, what I would start with is I'd go back on an anti-inflammatory before I touch the Tramadol. So I would use Aleve because it's a twice-a-day drug. I would take three tablets twice a day. It's a bit of a high dose, but that's what I would start with. So I'd be on Aleve for probably a week to 2 weeks. And then what I would do is you may go through some withdrawal, but I would reduce. You're taking a total, as you said, of four tablets a day. So I would reduce it by one half tablet every 3 days. That's what I would do. And
gotcha.
I would taper off. I would tough it out. You're going to have some side effects from it. And then when you're off of it completely, see if the Aleve does what you need for it. In other words, the Aleve may do it. However, let's assume for a second that you go off of it and your knee pain returns and you go, you know what? This pain is back. Go back on the Tramadol. It's very well tolerated. You're on 200 milligrams a day. If it's doing the trick, I would stay on it. But I would still probably every 6 months or 1 year try to taper off and see whether or not you need to be on it. I think with any chronic pain medication, it's there for a while and it's useful to see if you can taper off of it.
Yep. All righty.
That's what I would do. Good luck in that. Sometimes these pain syndromes last, as you said, for 3 to 5 years, and then they get better. You're doing the right thing. It's a well-tolerated drug, but if you can get off of it, that's even better for your body.
Gotcha. Sounds good, then.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. And before another short break, Zorba, it's time for you to throw on your powdered wig and black robe for another case of Judge Zorba. Today's case comes to us from a listener named Dale, who wants to get to the meat of an issue. Dale writes, Dr. Gentle and Mr. Snide, set the record straight on red meat. How much is okay? Recent studies are saying, essentially, none. I love red meat. I have a grilled steak or bacon Swiss and avocado burger, five or six times a month,
uh-huh,
with a pint,
uh-huh,
of great,
uh-huh,
IPA.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And Dale adds the postscript, kidding, Tom, about Mr. Snide. We need you advocating for traditional male voice and appetite whenever possible.
I love it. I love it. Mr. Snide. Now, was he really kidding? Well, that's a kind of a snide remark, whether he was kidding or not. So, First thing out of the box, I had a patient in my office the other day, and I said, how do you like Wisconsin? New guy. Mm-hmm. Had been here for 6 months. He came out east from Boston, and he said, you guys put bacon and cheese on everything you eat. So reminded me, it's exactly right, on everything you eat. I said, we don't put it on breakfast cereal. Mm-hmm. I said, but we do put cheese on pie. So it reminds me, 4 or 5 times a month is not going to kill you. Now, if I'm a Puritan, I'll say, no, don't have it at all. On the other hand, if you've got heart disease, you don't want to have it even 4 or 5 times a month. You want to reduce it to maybe once or twice a month. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have that much 4 or 5 times a week, which mm-hmm. is what I thought you were going to say. Less red meat is always best. Is a vegetarian diet better for you on the whole? Yes, but will it make you happy? I think happiness is an important part of longevity, and therefore, I am not a vegetarian because when I was one, I wasn't as happy.
Well, no.
Choose your diet well to fit your personality.
But now that's not very judicial. We need a definitive ruling
on
this.
You mean it's either yes or no? Four to five times a month. How much meat is it going to be? Okay, the answer is, here comes the gavel, too much. Reduce it to twice a month and you'll be better.
You know, Zorba, I bet your gavel would work really well to tenderize good steak.
I'll try it.
Give your lifestyle debates their day in court. Add your case to the docket by sending your affidavit or email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
An interesting topic to talk about coming up next. We have more of your calls on a medical myth buster. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, we talk some about anxiety and vaccines.
That's right. Very interestingly, it turns out that if you're anxious or you're wailing or you're crying when you get a vaccine, that may actually make your vaccine work better. And I'll tell you
what. Work better?
That's right. It actually may work better. There's some interesting research. This is biological research on mice, where they took mice and they actually stressed mice. There are ways that you can actually stress mice in a very rigorous way. Gave them vaccines and discovered that the stressed mice had a greater response to the vaccine than the non-stressed mice. In other words, they stressed them out, gave the vaccine, looked at antibiotics, and lo and behold, the antibodies were higher in the stressed mice.
Well, why would this be?
You've got to think about it from what happens evolutionarily. You're being chased by an animal, a bear, another human. Okay. And what happens is your body, I know that hasn't happened to you recently, right? Where a bear was chasing you.
Maybe a human.
Maybe a human, but not a bear. But what happens is you're going to be attacked. And so your body sends out adrenaline, epinephrine, norepinephrine, which are stress hormones, and a whole cascade of other stress hormones because you're going to be attacked.
Yeah.
And these hormones increase the immune system because you may be attacked and then you've got to basically bind up your body. You're not supposed to get infected. And so there's an immunological response that occurs with flight or fright. Now, when a baby is in a doctor's office in this day and age, they don't get one vaccine. They don't get two vaccines. They don't get three vaccines. When early infants actually get 4 vaccines and they are wailing. You know, they get poked and they have shots. And this is very interesting data that maybe that multiple vaccines are good together. They make the body more immune, but maybe the kids crying is actually an evolutionary response.
So if I'm getting a shot, I should
cry.
Cry.
That's exactly
it. I should be upset.
When you're in the office,
oh, no.
You should actually cry and no, say, oh, no, right, right, and start crying and
I
getting
upset. I
wonder
if you could fake it to have that same effect.
Well, I can't. Can you fake crying? But this goes along with some other issues, which is that when you're under chronic stress all the time, it appears that it exacerbates other parts of the immune system. Asthma is worse under chronic stress. Allergies appear to be worse under chronic stress. And autoimmune disorders appear to be worse under chronic stress. And they also are immunological responses. But I think from a parental point of view, having your child cry in the doctor's office may actually not be a bad sign, but it may actually be a good sign that your child is boosting their immune system. You should say, way to go, baby. Keep on crying. It's better for your immune system when you're getting your shot.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, our next caller is in Billings, Montana. Hi.
Hello, Tom.
What's up?
My son just had to be at the doctor for the third time this year because he had a sore throat. And the doctor said what the doctor previously said to me the last time I took him in, which was, it doesn't look like strep throat. It's probably something else that's going around. And when they came back in with the test results, the doctor then had to say, as the previous doctor had also had to say, oh, it is strep throat. So I then said to the doctor, well, my son is prone to strep. And the doctor said in his doctor voice, oh, yes.
In his doctor voice. I love yeah. it. I can picture that. Yeah. Authoritarian doctor voice.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Demonstrate for us, yeah. Zorba.
As it appears to be so.
Yes.
How does that sound? Or yes, madam,
yes.
It does appear to be so.
Well, that's pretty much what happened. But then my question for you, Dr. Zorba, is what does that mean to be prone to strep?
First of all, some kids get strep more than other kids, and we don't take out their tonsils unless they have major tonsil issues. In other words, their tonsils are too big, they're having trouble breathing, strep is there. Sometimes we do remove the tonsils for recurrent strep, but that's kind of the secondary thing. One recommendation I would have is get a culture done when he's finished taking his medication and make sure the strep is cured. Sometimes it's not cured. In other words, sometimes you need a second treatment. So you want to make sure that it's not in there harboring, staying there. That's number one. Number two, some kids get strep more than others. Well, that's just the way it is. And so what you do is you go in, you get a quick strep test, because you can't always tell by looking in the throat in some kids. Your son is a good example of that. And when they have strep, then you treat it. And when they stop having strep, then you don't treat it. And some kids just need, you know, a few courses, maybe 5 or 10 courses of antibiotics, maybe over a 5 or 10 year period for their strep. And then their body builds up enough immunity so they can fight it. For whatever, you know, we don't really have an explanation for it. Your son does not have an immune deficiency disease. If he's okay with the antibiotics and get better, I do not recommend tonsillitis. It's an overused surgery still in this country. Mm. It's way overused. It should be used. Probably should cut the rates by 50 to 60%. I'm very much against it. It's not what you're feeding him, but you should culture it when it's done to make sure that it's gone. That's what I would do. Now, one other thing. Do you or your family get strep throat at all?
Actually, yes. His sister, who is a year older and who is stuck to him like glue whenever she can be, never has had strep.
Has never had strep. Okay.
I get it at least every other time that he gets
it. Oh, you get it every other time.
Yeah.
Well, I have one other recommendation. Sometimes strep can hide in your nose. I mean, it actually can be in your nose. So you may want to have your nose cultured to make sure you or your son are not harboring strep and that it's actually in your nose. And I would culture both of your noses to see whether or not strep is being harbored in your nose. And if that's the case, sometimes other antibiotics with a few other drugs can actually make a difference and get it out of your nose because it may be sitting there.
Take him back to the doctor then, because he got off of antibiotics less than a week ago, and this morning he said his throat hurt.
Yeah, get him cultured. Culture.
Yeah.
I would make sure it's a culture cure at the end of every round of proven. He doesn't have to be looked at. He just needs a culture.
Okay. Well, thank you. very much, Dr.
You're welcome.
Zorba.
You're welcome. A pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth today from Dean in Marshfield, Wisconsin. Dean writes, "Hello, Dr. Zorba. Here's a medical myth buster question for you. Are earlobe creases an indicator of heart disease?"
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And this, and I have to tell you, this particular medical myth, which, by the way, was started by an article a number of years ago, more than a decade ago, from University of Chicago Research. But this particular medical myth has persisted and persisted and persisted, and study after study after study following that have shown you cannot look at earlobe creases and say that somebody has heart disease.
I wonder how that research was.
Well, it was a study, and they happened to notice that a lot of people who had earlobe creases had heart disease, so they made the speculation that this was a sign of heart disease, and then future studies disproved it. And that's kind of how science works. I mean, a lot of times with science, you'll have one study, and then the second study says no in future studies, but it's a myth that's persisted. Now, I do want to give an example of where you can see something on the skin that actually does show there's heart disease, and it's something called xanthal asthma.
What's
and
that?
Xanthal is with an X. You know, who knows why it's with an X. And there are cholesterol deposits in the skin. It's called xanthal asthma, and that can occur. That often occurs under the eyes, near the eyes. That can occur on the ears, and if you see that, it's yellow deposits of cholesterol, then you may have heart disease, not the skin.
I wonder if that research, that initial research, looked at all ages of people and found that some people had,
creased
creases
earlobes
in their Isn't that more likely in an older person?
Yeah, maybe
isn't it more likely an older person?
That's right. I don't think they were at the mall checking the ears of young girls who were getting their ears pierced. Yes.
Well, if you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust or pierce, just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Again, 800-462-7413. And a listener with us now, Zorba, in St. Luther County, Florida. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Yes, I was diagnosed with from the ER emergency room with a small hernia.
Okay.
They said something about the wear trusses, but it kind of had me in a cough or whatever, and they feel like a tear down there.
Right.
And he was saying that it could sometimes poke through the intestinal walls or whatever and twist itself and cut off the blood circulation.
Right. That
well, my
happen.
Thing is, my left arm and left leg be weak, feeling all the time. And I was trying to find out, they did like an ultrasound on my stomach.
Okay.
But I get stomach pains, like, mostly both sides and down to the bottom area. Occasionally up around the top.
Okay.
But nothing pokes out around my navel or nothing like that. Look like my stomach. I put on a good little bit of weight, so I think I just got weight stomach.
Yeah, you probably do. Well, yeah, weight is weight. Hernias, by the way, hernias are a tear in the abdominal wall. In other words, when you get a hernia, which is, down in the groin area, it's a tear in the abdominal wall. We usually fix them because they're uncomfortable. And if a piece of intestine twists and the circulation goes down, what happens is you can then need emergency surgery. So they're usually not an emergency type operation, but most guys get them fixed. And I say guys because hernias affect men more than women. Very common operation, usually done under the scope, and people feel better. And if you've got lower abdominal pain, it's possible, not for sure, but just possible that the lower abdominal pain is because a piece of intestine is getting stuck in that hernia. That definitely is a possibility. Hard to say without an exam, but that's not an uncommon thing. But not on the left side of your legs or your arms. And what I do when I see guys in my office, and I have a lot of truckers who I actually see and do exams on, I'll say, you pick a time when you want to have the surgery. You have it done by a surgeon who often will do the surgery through a scope. The scope is a better way to do it because it's a quicker recovery. You assume you're going to be off of work for a week. Might be a little longer, but it might be a week. But when you go back to work, you still can't do a lot of heavy lifting for a while. So you've got to look at what you're actually transporting and make sure that you don't do heavy lifting because you don't want to ruin the surgical repair that's down there.
Okay. I do no touch freight, so I don't really lift or touch none of the freight that I haul.
So you'd be back to work sooner than most if it's no touch freight. But if you've got a hernia there, generally you want to pick a time to get it done because you're going to need it done sooner or later. They only get worse. They don't get better. The old-fashioned treatment was something that was called a truss, like you said, and that's where it was a little weight that pushed in the hernia and kept it in. They got dirty. They're not good. Hernia repairs are really the way to go. But pick your time. Choose a surgeon that does it through a scope. That's the most important thing.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you for your call.
Before we leave for the week, Zorba, let's help out a very hip grandma during this round of Stump the Doc. A listener named Nana sent this note to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox via her iPad about a pungent problem one of her grandchildren is having. She writes, "Our
pungent.
Pungent.
Okay, well, I can guess.
You'll get it.
Grandchild, you'll get it. Pungent. I got it. Okay.
You'll get you'll get it,
I'll get it in
a second. Our almost 7-year-old grandson has the smelliest feet you can imagine for a little guy. When he takes his shoes off, his feet smell really yeasty. We've tried odor eaters, washing his feet more thoroughly, etc., to no avail. They're even stinky with brand new tennis shoes. We've tried to determine if it's something in his diet, but the only two things he eats every day would be milk and yogurt. This child eats a well-balanced diet. Do you have any idea what might cause this and what the solution would be? Thanks, Nana."
Well, first of all, a well-balanced diet is not milk and yogurt. You need fruits and vegetables. I mean, I'm from Wisconsin. I could say milk and yogurt are part of the diet. But
you're not a balanced diet.
It's not a balanced diet to just have milk and yogurt. So eating a well-balanced diet is great. It's not going to have anything to do with this. This is usually due to sweating. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. So I've got a couple of quick suggestions. First of all, changing shoes is great. Changing socks once during the day, make sure it's a cotton sock. And if you want to change it in the middle of the day, that helps. Spray his feet with antiperspirant spray and see if that works. You want to cut down on the swelling, on the sweating. And if not, I'd go to DrySol, DrySol, DrySol. You can get it. They also come in pads. And once a week, applying DrySol to his feet will cut down the sweating tremendously. And that's where the smell is coming from. It's from sweat.
If you have a lifestyle issue that doesn't pass the smell test, send it to the show to see if it stumps Zorba. Just send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. Or don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
And, of course, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Executive producer Adam Friedrich and technical director Brad Kohlberg are the Garth and Kat duo of radio production and are responsible for this hour. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidrick. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0622Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.